From NPR and WBUR, I'm Tanya Mosley.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now. Six Democratic candidates will meet to debate in Nevada tonight ahead of the state's caucuses on Saturday. And among them is former New York City Mayor Michael Bloomberg. This is the first debate he has qualified for, and he is sure to face challenges from his rivals, some of whom have said he is trying to buy the election. Let's bring in NPR senior political editor and correspondent Domenico Montanaro. Hi, Domenico.
Hello, Jeremy.
So first of all, before we get to this debate, I understand you have some new details about that NPR PBS NewsHour Marist poll that came out yesterday, which, by the way, qualified Bloomberg for the debate because he needed another one above 10%. But you've got some new details about how people feel about socialism. And of course, the front runner in the race right now, Bernie Sanders, calls himself a democratic socialist.
Yeah, you know, it's funny. We wanted to test just the favorability ratings of socialism versus capitalism, if things have changed, how people view them. And it's pretty stark and mirror images of each other that when it comes to socialism, just 28% of Americans have a favorable view of socialism. 58% said they have an unfavorable impression of it. And it was the opposite with capitalism. It was 57% positive with capitalism. And, you know, what's interesting about this is people might ask, well, why is Bernie Sanders on the rise if socialism is not, you know, seen as very popular? Mm-hmm. And I know there's a difference between, quote unquote, democratic socialism versus socialism. But it's not as big a liability in the Democratic primary because half of Democrats and two thirds of progressives actually view socialism positively. You know, and when Sanders talks about this, he's talking about bringing in some of those European style policies like having health care as a basic universal right and free college.
Let's talk about the debate. Bloomberg is going to be the fresh face on tonight's stage, and voters have not heard much from him yet other than his multi-million dollar ad campaign. What is at stake for him tonight in an unscripted format?
There's a lot at stake. I mean, he has flooded the airwaves with his ads. He spent more than $300 to $400 million now on advertising across the country. And, you know, he's got to be able to live up to this image he's painted of himself. He's 78 years old. He hasn't been on a debate stage in 11 years. It takes a little while, as we've seen with some of these candidates sometimes, to kind of warm up at these debates. But he's got to come in and be a primetime player right away. There's no sort of, you know, ability for him to kind of have an okay debate or, you know, not do so great. You know, and Bloomberg has a reputation, you know, when he was New York mayor, he could be somewhat, you know, churlish at times, you know, not the most friendly to everybody all the time. So how he comes across versus how these advertisements have made him look is going to be really interesting.
And what about Sanders? Is he going to have a target on his back tonight as well from some of his rivals who have seen him do so well in the first two early contests?
I'm going to be fascinated to watch how Elizabeth Warren interacts with Bernie Sanders because the two of them have had this sort of non-aggression pact. They're very lightly jabbed at each other over Medicare for All and their differences on it. But Warren, our polling is showing that she's the top second choice candidate among all of the candidates, but the lion's share of that comes from Bernie Sanders supporters. So she's got this roadblock in her way with Sanders, and she's at risk of having the movement leave her behind as she has been trying to forward it with Bernie Sanders this entire time.
And what about the other three who will be on stage tonight, Biden, Buttigieg, and Klobuchar? What do they have to do?
Yeah, I think that former Vice President Biden has been in a nosedive in this election. He finished fourth and fifth in Iowa and New Hampshire. That really puts a dent in his electability argument. He's got to do at least okay in the debate. I don't think he can help himself in the debate very much, but I think he can really hurt himself if he has a poor showing. You know, and Amy Klobuchar, Pete Buttigieg, their momentum has seemed to sort of stall after these two overwhelmingly white states. While we now look at Nevada and South Carolina, which provide much more diverse electorates, they need to be able to show that they can, again, have strong showings at this debate so that they can win over or at least improve with voters of color.
Do you think that this debate is going to make a difference for voters on Saturday in Nevada?
It's always hard to predict. You know, sometimes debates have a small impression or don't make much of a difference. And then other times, like right before New Hampshire, we saw Amy Klobuchar have a strong debate and then did quite well. So we're going to, you know, I think debates are always important. Bloomberg is going to be at the center. How he deals with the incoming is going to be the most important thing to watch tonight.
That's NPR senior political editor and correspondent Domenico Montanaro. Domenico, thank you.
You're welcome.
Let's check in now on the coronavirus. One of the most mysterious parts of this virus is just how fast it's spreading. There's now 74,000 cases in mainland China, and more than 2,000 people have died from it. And while China says the number of new cases is tapering off, some experts believe the spread of the virus is just getting started. For more, we have with us now Dr. Michael Osterholm, director of the Center for Infectious Disease Research and Policy at the University of Minnesota. He's also written several books on killer germs. Doctor, thanks for being here.
Thank you.
So, Doctor, first, we're now several weeks into the spread of this strain of coronavirus. Based on what you know about the spread of this virus, what do you make of China's claim that the rate of new cases is slowing down? Do you think we're at a turning point?
Actually, we're only in the very first days of this outbreak, and we have many more months to go. We are expecting fully that this could reemerge back in China. So the leveling off of cases doesn't at all give us an indication they're done with it. The second thing is this virus, which spreads like influenza virus, which I have likened to trying to stop the wind, is now throughout the rest of the world. And we are in many countries around the world, in like Wuhan was in those early days of December, where it was 2, 4, 8, 16, 32 cases with each new generation of transmission. And so we wouldn't expect to see most of the world really demonstrating a severe problem until probably the next 3 or 4 weeks. The final piece of this is that we don't really know how many people are infected. We have many areas of total, you might say, virus blackout, where there's no testing available, or if it is, it's very limited. We could see a major rebound in cases in China just in a few short weeks.
Oh, wow.
Many of the cases will be mild to almost asymptomatic, up to 80% of the cases. The challenge we have here, though, is it's going to infect a lot more people because, like influenza, as you've seen, whether it be the cruise ship or hospital, look at this, over 1,700 healthcare workers in China have been infected just caring for patients. That gives you a sense of how infectious this is.
Can I ask you a little bit more about those doctors and nurses who seem to be getting infected and then also dying? I mean, we just saw this other prominent doctor who was a chief at a hospital in Wuhan who has died. He's the 8th healthcare worker to die of this disease so far. And they're not what we really think to be folks who would be susceptible to dying from a virus like, say, the flu. They're younger. We don't know of any underlying medical conditions. What could be the reason for that?
Well, first of all, you have to understand everyone is vulnerable to dying from this virus, whether you're a young child to an elderly person with underlying health conditions. The rate of those severe illnesses and deaths is much higher in the older population. But as you saw, the original 34-year-old physician who was the one who really first pinpointed this problem and put it on the internet at the end of December also has died. Again, no underlying health condition. So I think these two physicians, the 34-year-old one and the 51-year-old you just mentioned, actually do demonstrate that this is a very serious illness affecting all ages.
A few years ago, you created a 9-point strategy on how to address and prevent infectious diseases like a global flu pandemic. How would your strategy play out in this case? I'm just astounded by what you're saying, that in the next few weeks, we might see this spread and be more severe in other parts of the world?
Well, unfortunately, the book you're referring to and published in 2017, Deadliest Enemies, Our War Against Killer Germs, actually chapter 13 happened to be on coronaviruses, and the title of that chapter was SARS and MERS, A Harbinger of Things to Come. So, you know, many of us in this business obviously realize new infectious agents are going to emerge, but this one should have been no surprise to us. In 2009, when H1N1 emerged, the pandemic strain that we had that year, we actually saw in the first month that the virus was in at least 47 different countries after it was first discovered. Move that fast. Today, we're at 26 countries with this virus. And the reason we're not at 47 or more is because the vast majority of the countries in the world can't even test for it. If they could have, I would tell you we have a repeat of what we saw in 2009. And in that sense, we can expect this virus to move around the world. And I don't know what would make it change from how it's operating in China than it would in any other country of the world.
Doctor, with all of what you're saying, how does this end? Is there any way that we can take some sort of precautions to not see what you're expecting that we see?
Well, first of all, we have to protect our healthcare workers. They are the soldiers on the front line against this bug. If we don't, we will see what's happening in China, where we'll see so many healthcare workers go from critical key providers of care to someone who desperately needs care. That's the biggest challenge we have right now. And one of the problems is the fact that no one has money in the healthcare systems today around the world to invest in stockpiles of masks, the kind of respirators you need, the kinds of suits you need to effectively provide this care and protect the healthcare workers. This is coming. I really believe that we're going to see much more of it around the world, and the best thing we can do is prepare our healthcare system.
Dr. Osterholm, an infectious disease expert at the University of Minnesota. Doctor, thank you so much.
Thank you.
The urban-rural divide has grown in politics over the past couple decades, and rural America has become increasingly and reliably Republican. But Jane Klebb, chair of the Nebraska Democratic Party, says there are a lot of opportunities for Democrats to win back rural voters in local, state, and national politics. She writes about how in her book, Harvest the Vote, How Democrats Can Win Again in Rural America, which is just out. Jane, welcome to Here and Now.
Thank you.
So let's get to what your book is all about, which is that, as you say, Democrats have been ignoring rural voters in America. Tell us more. Why do you say that?
You know, it's really been since the 1980s when you had Jesse Jackson and Senator Tom Harkin really going to rural voters and standing with them when they were hurting. So that was the height of the farm crisis when suicide rates were high, folks didn't have access to health care, and big banks were closing in on family farms and ranches. And the Democratic Party really stood with rural communities and passed a comprehensive farm bill with their voices included. And then we forgot about them. You know, there's lots of lessons for us to be learned on how we can win back those rural voters by standing with them when they're being threatened by big pipelines or with the flooding and other impacts of climate change. But the National Democratic Party has been slow to respond.
Why do you think that is?
You know, I often hear a lot of stereotypes from urban voters saying that, you know, rural people are voting against their best interests. I understand on the one hand how you can think that looking into rural communities, but if you live in a small rural town, you feel forgotten, you feel isolated. And, you know, President Trump made it a point to really reach out to rural voters and use language that they thought that he was going to stand up for them. Obviously, the Republican Party has used a lot of cultural wedge issues like guns, abortion, and immigration to keep us all divided as a country. But Democrats can actually go into rural communities and show that we are the party that stands up for the little guy.
Well, when Republicans and when President Trump does, as you say, use these hot button wedge issues to attract rural voters, whether it be abortion or gay rights or guns, what are Democrats supposed to do?
You know, we have to be honest with voters that we are going to have different perspectives on gun reform and abortion and immigration. And that is okay. And that we have common ground when it comes to keeping our rural hospitals and schools open. And that we have common ground on protecting folks' property rights from eminent domain. When rural voters think you're not being honest with them on the cultural issues, then they will turn away from us on even economic interest issues. And that may, you know, pull your hair out because you may be saying, well, they're voting against their best interests, but they will think that they can't trust you. They need to know that we're fighting for them. And right now, they don't believe that. If we're not investing real money into helping candidates in rural communities and helping red and rural state parties rebuild, we're going to keep on facing this cycle of mutual neglect.
Well, let me just push you on that for a minute, because if you look at economic issues, one of the things that obviously has been very important to rural communities in this country over the last couple of years has been the trade war with China and the tariffs that have gone into effect against China, which has been very difficult for farmers. And President Trump launched that government bailout to help the farmers deal with that. But we do hear many farmers who say that despite being hurt themselves by the trade war by President Trump, they still support him and they think he's doing the right thing. What case would you make to those voters?
There's no question that some rural farmers continue to stand with Donald Trump, even though they are economically hurt by President Trump's trade wars. But if there's no alternative, if we're not giving them an alternative, if we're not talking to them on a regular basis and showing them that we're different, then they're going to continue to vote with Republicans.
Are you hearing an alternative right now on the trade issue from any of the Democratic candidates for president?
You know, the good thing is, and that's one of the bonuses of Iowa going first, is that all of our Democratic candidates really do have strong rural proposals. You know, as an advocate and as a state party chair, I'm going to be in the ears of those presidential campaigns that you can't just talk about rural issues once in Iowa and check the box and think that you can then move on. So we have to do a better job about talking about not only trade, but talking about property rights and rural hospitals and some of the other economic issues that are facing our rural communities all the time.
I'm glad you brought up rural hospitals because you do talk about that in this book. And when we think of healthcare, generally, when we talk about healthcare, it's about who has access really to health insurance. But what you point out is that for rural Americans, they may have health insurance. They might even have good health insurance. But there is a crisis of access in many rural areas in this country. And not a lot of people on either side are talking about that.
That's right. So you have moms who are pregnant that are having to travel an hour to get to a hospital. Our daughter has autism, and we live in a small town of 25,000. So that's big relative to some other rural towns. But it took us 8 months to get an appointment with a mental health therapist for Maya. That is unacceptable. We don't have enough mental health therapists in our small town in order to meet the needs of our kids and adults who have mental illness. And if we had a child who had to be inpatient for an eating disorder or another mental illness, we would literally have to put our kid on a plane to Denver or another big city because there's not an inpatient treatment facility anywhere near us. So there's a real crisis happening, and there's real common ground that Democrats can stand on to show that we're standing up for our families. But we got to start talking about it on a regular basis.
You bring up your experience fighting against the Keystone XL pipeline as an example of effective grassroots organizing in rural Nebraska. That project was rejected by the Obama administration, but it has been resurrected by President Trump. What did you learn from that experience of getting rural voters together to oppose something that the National Democratic Party did end up opposing, basically?
You know, this was a real unlikely alliance that took us, you know, 3 years to develop trust among farmers, ranchers, tribal nations, as well as kind of progressive climate advocates. We showed rural communities in Montana, in South Dakota, and in Nebraska that Democrats were standing with them. And that was a real shift. And I know personally, you know, hundreds of farmers and ranchers who are no longer Republicans anymore that were involved in that fight. Some of them are actually not Democrats, but the vast majority could not. That's a bridge too far, but they're registered independents. But they have started to see Democrats in a very different light. So that's what we need to do. And that's what I'm arguing is that, you know, there are issues when it comes to Medicaid expansion, eminent domain, climate change, protecting small family farms from corporate agriculture. These are all issues that urban Democrats agree with as well.
Let me ask you about the presidential race that's going on right now. Is there anybody in the field that you think could not win rural voters in this country?
I think every single Democratic candidate that's in the primary, including Bloomberg, including Sanders, both of them can win, and everybody in between can win. The question for me is, will they put resources on the ground? Because what often happens is that we play in this swing state map. That model is outdated. President Trump has rewired the electoral map. We have to play everywhere, including in states like Nebraska and South Dakota.
But do you think that a Democratic candidate for president is going to be doing rallies in rural areas of this country, or will they mainly, as usual, be focused on cities where they can attract more people all at once?
By 2040, 80% of the population is going to be concentrated in 15 to 17 states. That means that less than 50% of the population is going to be electing 84% of the U.S. senators. So we, as a Democratic Party, have to decide this election cycle if we're actually going to be taking rural states and rural voters seriously, because otherwise we are literally handing elections over to the Republican Party, even though Democrats will have the majority of votes when you look at popular vote versus electoral college. I'm definitely telling presidential candidates in their campaigns and their surrogates that they have to start showing up in rural communities if we're going to win the White House, but more importantly, if we're going to win some of the U.S. Senate seats. And I know people often only look at the shiny object of the White House, but we have to look at the structure of how we elect people, because we actually can elect Democrats in these rural states if they have the resources to run and win.
Well, you talk in this book about the importance of the Democratic Party focusing on local races in addition to Senate races and obviously the presidency.
That's right. In Nebraska, we had 850 Democrats run across our state in 2018, and 73% of them won. And that was a lot of down ballot races, mayor, city council members, school board members, state legislators. So we can start to build a very strong bench where also local control matters. You know, you can impact climate change and the issues we care about, like expanding Medicaid. That can be controlled at the state level. But what we have done for many years, I would argue for the past 20 years, we've completely ignored state parties, and they are the backbone of every single candidate on the Democratic ballot, from president all the way down. If we're going to start winning in these red states and rural states again, you have to fully invest in state parties.
Do you think that Nebraska will be in play in 2020?
Nebraska is unique, very similar to Maine, where we split our electoral votes by congressional district. And so there's no question, both our congressional district one, which has Lincoln and a lot of small towns, as well as CD2, which includes our biggest city of Omaha, those districts are definitely in play for the electoral college map. You know, right now, unfortunately, presidential campaigns are not on the ground yet in Nebraska, but hopefully after Super Tuesday, presidential campaigns will get serious and start to play on the ground here in Nebraska.
That is Jane Klebb, who is chair of the Nebraska Democratic Party and author of the new book, Harvest the Vote: How Democrats Can Win Again in Rural America. Jane, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
And you can find an excerpt at hereandnow.org.
Last season, Giannis Antetokounmpo was the best player in the NBA, but the 25-year-old forward for the Milwaukee Bucks is especially popular among fans from Athens, Greece, who share his roots. Dan Mialopoulos from WBEZ reports on the player known as the Greek Freak.
It's Greek night at the Milwaukee Bucks game, and that means the starting lineup for the home team is being introduced in the language of Plato and Aristotle. The loudest applause is for Giannis, born and raised in Greece, or as the announcer calls it, Elada. Manolis Olandezos is the son of immigrants from the Greek island of Samos who settled in the Chicago area, and he went to Milwaukee for the Bucks Greek night in January.
You see a lot of the Greek pride come out, and I think the Greeks want to gravitate towards someone, especially when there hasn't been someone like that in the NBA. Now we have someone that we can wrap our arms around.
With his African roots, Giannis does not look like most of the Greeks here. His parents were immigrants themselves. They moved to Greece from Nigeria. Giannis rose quickly from peddling DVDs on the streets of Athens to winning the Most Valuable Player Award in the NBA last year. During the NBA's All-Star Weekend in Chicago recently, former President Barack Obama invited Giannis to participate in a panel discussion. Giannis talked about Greek neighbors who had helped his struggling immigrant parents.
They were illegal, basically, so we had to have our circle really tight and really close and trust people that, you know, put us in the position that we are today. You know, I'm the MVP. I'm in a position that we can give back. All I know is that people gave to me, I got to give back.
Olandezos says this success story has special resonance with Greeks in this country and their descendants.
A lot of our parents and grandparents have come over to the States with, as they would tell us when they were younger, $5 to $10 in their pocket, and they made it big. Yanni started from nothing and developing into this worldwide superstar. And I think Greeks, as my boss would say, Greeks are everywhere.
And so are Yanni's Greek fans. Wherever the Bucks play, Yanis gets a modern Greek hero's welcome from his countrymen and women living in the U.S. and Canada. When the Bucks took on the Celtics in Boston, Greek Americans performed folk dances in his honor on the court at halftime. And outside Madison Square Garden, after the Bucks game against the New York Knicks, they flocked around Yanis to pose for selfies or ask him for an autografo, his autograph. After the recent Greek night at Milwaukee's Fiserv Forum, a couple thousand Greeks stick around after the game. Yanis comes back out onto the court with his brother and teammate Thanasis. Yanis sings along and nods his head as the crowd serenades him and Thanasis with the Greek national anthem. Then Yanni grabs the microphone and addresses everybody, in Greek, of course. Yanni tells us Greek night was tremendous. We appreciate you supporting our family. The best is yet to come. Thank you very much. With Yanni's having another strong season and the Bucks holding the league's best record so far, he could soon win another MVP award and then reach even higher Olympus-level peaks in the NBA playoffs. For Here and Now, I'm Dionysis Michalopoulos.
In the new Netflix film, Horse Girl, Alison Brie stars as Sarah, a horse-loving young woman who sells fabric in a craft store. She takes Zumba, binge-watches her favorite TV show, and her roommate tries to get her to date.
Hey, Brian's new roommate is single. Maybe we could all go out sometime?
Maybe.
All right. Have fun.
You too.
It all seems very ordinary, but then Sarah's life takes an eerie turn. She experiences time loss, has dreams of being taken into a mysterious white room, and bruises on her body that she can't explain. Though Sarah has a theory.
I'm like being taken. I'm like being abducted by aliens. And like, I think that they're cloning me.
Could Sarah have been abducted by aliens? Or could her experience be connected to her family history of mental illness? Horse Girl is now available via streaming. And Alison Brie is not only the star, she also co-wrote the script. And she joins me now to talk more about it. Welcome.
Thank you.
Well, Alison, can we talk first about the title Horse Girl? Would you explain for listeners who don't know, what is a horse girl?
Sure. I would be so surprised if people really didn't know. I think most people probably have met a horse girl in their lives. It's an archetype, I guess, that existed when we were in middle school or high school. To me, a horse girl is someone who sort of existed on the outskirts of social society at school. Not to say that she didn't have friends, but she had this extracurricular hobby that took a lot of time. I think horse girls had a bit of mystery to them, and they were very confident. They sort of didn't seem to care what was going on at school because they had this other interest that was such a big part of their lives. But they weren't exactly, you wouldn't say they were like cool, but they weren't exactly nerdy. There was sort of an ethereal quality. They had great posture.
Well, great posture for obvious reasons. Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, to us, the horse girl quality for Sarah, it's we wanted to look at a horse girl where we're picking up later in her life when she's sort of no longer a horse girl. The horse is no longer hers, and she really can't ride the horse anymore, and she's disconnected from the happiest time in her life and sort of moments when she felt like everything was good and that she was okay and really stable.
Yeah. This film combines so many elements. There is this horse girl archetype. There's also alien abduction and cloning, which sounds like an episode of The X-Files. And then there is this history of mental illness. Sarah's mother had depression. Her grandmother was committed to a mental institution. What made you want to combine all of these elements into one film?
Well, the jumping off point was my own family's history with mental illness. Similarly to Sarah, my grandmother had paranoid schizophrenia. My mother lives with depression. And yeah, I've lived my life with this knowledge of mental illness in my bloodline and a fair amount of fear about if and when that would sort of come out in my lifetime. So that was really the jumping off point. And then, you know, my grandmother's paranoia was not quite as supernatural. She didn't really have alien theories. She had other conspiracy theories about the government and her doctors and other people who she thought were tapping, you know, the phone lines and bugging her house, which of course was not the case. But I sort of wanted to take it into this direction of being a bit more in the sci-fi genre. And maybe that's just because I haven't worked much in that genre. And I was kind of interested in just doing a movie that kind of existed more in the sci-fi thriller space.
Yeah. You know, you bring up the point about fears when mental illness is in your genes. Can you talk a little bit more about that fear and how it actually plays out as you grow and you start to think about building your own family, just all of that that comes across for you when you have this history within your family?
Yeah, well, it's just something when you have that knowledge of it in your family that is, it's prevalent all the time. I've certainly experienced bouts of depression that have been very scary and seemingly never ending and have felt very helpless. And in those instances, it felt very unfair to me that because of my DNA or certain brain chemistry, things were happening. You know, depression is not necessarily linked to something horrible happening in your life. It can kind of, in my experience, it's been able to appear at any moment. That's not something that I'm deciding. It's so far out of my control. And that is terrifying. When I would think about myself, I would think, what if something started happening? What if I had some strange experience and I didn't have the power to know if I could trust my own mind? Like to be at odds with one's own mind is just a terrifying prospect.
Yeah, this film certainly puts us there. It puts us in Sarah's shoes in many ways because we're seeing the world based on her viewpoint. And so we get a taste of that. And, you know, it also crossed my mind, and I know I'm not alone in this idea that maybe mentally ill people are actually seeing reality and we are the ones who are not. And this film does not come to a decision on that, on whether Sarah is experiencing a psychotic break or if she's really being abducted by aliens. And that was very intentional, obviously.
Oh, absolutely. I've been really enjoying reading all of the different theories about what's going on at the end of the movie. And so that's been really fun. But our main intention was, as you said, just to put the audience in Sarah's shoes. It's a really subjective movie. We didn't want people to be on the outside of her experience. We didn't want to leave room for people to be judging her. You know, even though some of the characters in the movie seem to judge her or have a certain skepticism about what she's talking about, we wanted the audience to be along for the ride, experiencing that terror of not knowing what's real and what's not real until the very end.
Yeah. I know you're in the thick of this project. It's just recently come out and is streaming. But is this a, a topic that you want to delve more into as you deepen your work and create?
I don't know. This movie's been so cathartic for me because the subject matter is so personal. It's a subject matter that I've wanted to write something about my whole life. I've always had a fascination with my grandmother and her mental illness and how it affected the whole family in different ways. And so I kind of feel like I've explored that now. You know, this piece is my opus on that, and it is my artistic expression about my own personal fears of that nature. So I don't know that it's a topic that I'm pursuing outside of this film, but it's been incredibly gratifying to make this film and also to speak to so many people who have seen the movie, who have mental illness in their family, and to hear about how much the movie resonated with them.
Do you hope that this opens a pathway for deeper discussion about mental illness?
Absolutely. I think that was not necessarily our intention when writing it. You know, we didn't set out to make a mental illness movie point blank. You know, it was something that was born out of, again, this personal connection that I have to this personal fear, and then a real abstraction from that. You know, we sort of really took a lot of artistic license with how we wanted to tell the story, but most importantly, you know, putting the audience in the character's situation. And it's astonishing to me, even learning how many people, it's overwhelming the amount of people who have mental illness in their family or who experience mental illness. It's made me realize even how it's not talked about enough, how there continues to be a stigma about things even as common as depression. So again, you know, so it wasn't really our initial intention, but I've just been so excited by the reaction and I guess really grateful that it broke open this larger conversation. And I definitely think it's something that should be talked about more.
Allison Brie co-wrote and stars in the new Netflix film, Horse Girl. Allison, thank you so much for your work.
Thank you. Thank you for speaking to me.
Horse Girl is available on Netflix.
And a lot is going to be decided in the presidential race in the next 2 weeks. The Nevada caucuses are Saturday, the South Carolina primary is a week later, and 3 days after that, on March 3rd, it is Super Tuesday, when 14 states and one territory hold primaries or caucuses. When that's all over, about 40% of all delegates will have been awarded. We're going to look at some of those Super Tuesday states over the next week, starting today with Virginia, where a poll this week has Bernie Sanders and Michael Bloomberg tied for first place at 22% each. Joining us now by Skype is Larry Sabato, director of the University of Virginia Center for Politics. Larry, welcome.
Thank you so much.
Well, how is the race looking in Virginia?
It's looking unsettled, just like the national contest is looking unsettled. It's muddled here because it's muddled everywhere else. I think each primary and caucus is building on the last one. And at this point, while you've gone from weak front runner Joe Biden to weak front runner Bernie Sanders, there is no coalescing of opinion around a candidate. That's true here, although it could change before March 3rd.
But it was interesting to see that Bloomberg is doing as well in Virginia as he is. What do you make of that?
Fascinating, because just the day before that poll came out, I'd had a chance to talk with some major Democratic leaders, including some who will serve as superdelegates. And I interviewed them separately, and they all said the same thing. Maybe they talked, but they basically said they had been for Biden, and now if Biden continued to do poorly, and did not win convincingly in South Carolina, they were going to switch to Bloomberg. So I think that Bloomberg has become the alternative to Biden in order to stop Bernie Sanders. And those are now the three big players, at least they appear to be in most places.
Is Bloomberg running ads in Virginia the way he is in so many other states?
He's running more. At least I kind of suspect he is. I've never seen a candidate for any office air as many advertisements on as many channels as Michael Bloomberg has. And this has been going on for weeks. You can't turn on a television without seeing at least one of his ads. Sometimes there are two or three in a single commercial block.
Is anybody else running ads in Virginia that you've seen?
I haven't seen a single one. I've seen, obviously, coverage of national issues and of the other primaries and caucuses, but I don't think any of it's focused on Virginia. I have yet to see an ad from any candidate other than Bloomberg that's focused on Virginia.
Now, Virginia has an open primary process, so registered voters can vote in either the Republican or Democratic primary. What do you think that will mean for the Democratic primary this year?
Well, that's going to be interesting because we have an open primary. We don't have party registration, and any registered voter can cast a ballot. There have been times in the past few decades when one party without a contest has encouraged its members quietly to go into the voting booth and vote for the weakest candidate for the other party. There is some of that going on right now. And the consensus among Republicans is they're going to vote for Bernie Sanders.
Because they think he's the weakest candidate.
They think he's the weakest candidate by far. They would like nothing better than to run against a Democratic socialist. And frankly, I think they're right. I think Virginia would even be in play.
Now, Virginia has a Democratic governor and a Democratic majority in the state legislature for the first time in decades. It has been blue in the last few presidential elections. Hillary Clinton won in 2016, Obama won in 2008 and 2012. Would you say that Virginia is reliably blue this year, or is it still a purple state?
I like to say it's a purple state that is tinged blue. I'm a little less convinced than some others that Virginia will always vote Democratic. It has moved in the Democratic direction. Obviously, the last statewide election that Republicans won was in 2009. So it leans Democratic, but it's important to remember Hillary Clinton only won Virginia with a shade under 50%. So maybe Virginia is a couple points more Democratic than the rest of the country on average. But that doesn't mean it will always vote Democratic. The candidates matter, and Democrats cannot assume anything about Virginia or a lot of other swing states.
Larry Sabatow, while we have you, one more thing while we're talking Virginia politics. How's everything going with Governor Ralph Northam, who was all over the headlines because of the blackface incident that he was found in photographs showing he was in blackface years ago? He seems to have survived that.
He's not only survived, he's prospering. The fascinating thing about Northam is he has been buoyed by the fact that Virginia has become more Democratic and took over the legislature. A lot of that's due to Donald Trump. The reaction to Trump here is about as negative as you can get. And so Democrats took over both houses of the legislature, and they have passed 25 years of legislation that had been building up in the hopper but couldn't be passed because you either had Republicans in charge of one or both houses of the legislature or there was a Republican governor. Democrats now control everything in Virginia. And Northam has become a historic governor, amazingly, after almost being forced to resign.
That is Larry Sabatow, who's director of the University of Virginia Center for Politics. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you, Jeremy.
And Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Tanya Mosley. This is Here and Now.